Okay, we are on the 17th chapter, Parakeet Zion. Yep, we're flying. Okay, which is page 106. We saw in the last chapter how a man by the name of David, not yet King David, was involved in the palace, specifically when the king, King Shaul, was having difficulty, translated here as melancholy, or had some type of illness. He would come and play the musical instrument, the harp, and it would calm him down, he'd relax, and all would be fine and well. We're now going to see the 17th chapter, which discusses perhaps one of the most famous stories in all the books of the prophets, the war of the Philistines, that we had before, which won't be the last one either, but the famous war between two great, great men, David and Goliath. That's the name, the whole discussion really of this entire chapter, which will not finish because it's extremely lengthy, but at least we'll get a good start up. Pasukov, page 106, verse 1 says, V'yasku Pelishtim es machanehem l'milchama, that the Pelishtim assembled their camps to prepare for war. V'yasvu Socho asher Yehuda, and they assembled themselves in this place by the name of Socho, which was in Yehuda, which means they had already infiltrated into the Jewish area, Jewish camps. V'yachnu bein Socho bein Azeka be'efes damim. And they encamped between these two places, Socho and Azeka, in this place called Ephes Damim. And the question is, what exactly is Ephes Damim? So Rashi just starts off and helps us out. He says, Kach Shem HaMakom. It's the name of a place. It's a strange name, but that's the name of the place. We'll discuss the significance of this. It's actually brought down in the Radak. The Radak tells us the Ephes Damim. It says V'Rebbe Shmuel Bar Nachman Omer Shemisham Pasku Damim LeYisrael. It was there that the blood stopped for the Jewish people, which means that eventually this will be the place where the last war between David Hamelech and the Plishtim will take place, and therefore it means Ephes Damim. Damim means blood, and Ephes. I learned what that word was. I was watching a soccer game. It just means zero. I kept asking, what's the score? They kept saying, FS, 0-0. Now I know why I don't like soccer. But anyway, that's what it means, FS Damim, that there was no blood. When the blood had ceased in that area because the war eventually will end, the last war will be in that area. So it'll end up being called FS Damim. More importantly, one has to understand why the Plishtim decided again to start up with the Jewish people. What was the problem? The Plishtim weren't the nicest of folk. Because the problem was that we know that Shaul's son, Yonah's son, defeated them just a few months ago. And all of a sudden, here they come again, ready to fight us. Doesn't make any sense. We were able to defeat them, even though we were extremely outmatched. Still, we defeated them. And now, a few months later, they're coming back. So the Malbim explains the significance of why they're coming at this particular point. The Malbim says that they knew the strength, the power of the king, King Shaul. But now they also realized that this spirit that he had, this power, was gone. And that he lost this ability to really be a powerful king. And once his guard was down, they saw this, it was an opportunity for them to attack us. And that's really, it makes sense, because that's what we were just learning, how David is now going to end up taking over this position, eventually, soon, to be the king, and that Shaul is no longer capable of really being able to remain as king. So therefore, the Plishtim at this point come and are ready to attack us. Pasuk Beis, next Pasuk tells us, V'Shaul V'ish Yisrael Nesfu. So we had on one side all the Plishtim that were coming to do battle. On the other side you had Shaul and Ish Yisrael, people among the B'nai Yisrael, they gathered. Vayachnu b'emek ha'ele, and they encamped at such and such a place, which is an emek, a valley. V'yarku milchama likras plishtim, and they prepared themselves to do battle, to wage war against the plishtim. Now, some people explain, the Malbim tells us, there's a significance that it was be'emek. It was in a valley. What do you mean it was in the... So what? Be'emek ha'ele? Because we know that the plishtim not only were in middle territory, middle grounds, they actually already were in, as the first pasuk told us, in the area Asher Yehuda. They were already in Jewish territory. Normally when that happens, we should immediately attack them. But they didn't. They were so afraid of the plishtim that they didn't go and immediately attack them. Rather, they remained, says the Malbim, in an emek, in a valley, in a protect, in a way to distance themselves. They didn't completely go toward them. In fact, the Kli Yakar explains a very strange language of this pasuk. Who went to fight against the plishtim? Shaul. Okay, that makes sense. He's the king, after all. But then the pasuk says, V'ish Yisrael, which sounds like
one
guy, or certainly a very insignificant amount of people that were fighting against the plishtim. And it's explained by the Kli Yakar, the reason is because the Jewish people were so afraid that they just were not willing to go onto the battlefield. And it was only far and few people between that were willing to do this, to remain loyal to Shaul. And the plishtim saw this, that Shaul did not have the same power. Generally, it's not your choice. It's mandatory draft. You have to fight. The fact is that they saw that Shaul obviously doesn't even have control over his army, because who joins them? Ish Yisrael, such an insignificant amount of people. Okay, that's the second verse. Continuing with the next pasuk. Next psukim are going to really set the tone of exactly this war, exactly where it was, and we're also going to be introduced to a very powerful and very tall man. L'plishtim omdim el ha'har mizeh. So the Philistines, they were by one mountain. B'Yisrael omdim el ha'har mizeh. The Jewish people were by another mountain. That's where they ended up going to. V'gai b'nehem. And between them was this valley. So some explain that they originally were in the valley, and then we climbed up to a mountain. Some say that some of the people were in the mountain, some people stay in the valley. But either way, we were both facing each other on mountains, and in between was nothing but a valley. Now, because a military strategy, you always want to be in a high place, it would be very foolish for any person to walk down that mountain and to be vulnerable to attack right in the middle of a valley. That is to say, unless you feel that you're such an incredibly powerful, strong man, that there's no way anyone could ever defeat you. And that's exactly the man which you're going to see now. But Yetze Ish Habinayim, and there was a man that went between them. And some people interpret, what does it mean, between them? It means that between the Philistine army and the Jewish army. He walked right in between. So there was this man who went between them, Mimachnos Plishtim, who was coming from the Philistine army. And the name of his name, as said in Hebrew, is Golios, which is translated in English as Goliath, so whichever one sounds nice to you, use. Shmo, that was his name, Migas. And he came from this place called Gas. Gavoho, you want to know how tall this guy was? Maybe he was pretty small, a midget. No, he was very tall. Shesh Amos Vazares. He was the height of 6 cubits and a zeres. So, well, that's pretty tall. And an amma, a cubit, is generally measured, or is measured, from the elbow to the tip of one's middle finger, which some translate, there's a discrepancy exactly how long that is. So the average male hand cubit is between 18 inches and 24 inches. Right? That's what a cubit is. It's measured 18 to 24 inches, depending on obviously how tall the guy is. So he was a pretty tall guy. In fact, it says on page 107 in the English, it says Goliath, some people say he's a little shorter than this, but it says here Goliath was a 13-foot giant. So he'd be a pretty good player in the Knicks. They could probably use him. Who challenged the Jews to settle the war by sending a single warrior to engage him in individual combat, as we'll see in the next pasuk. Now, what exactly does this mean? He was six amos and a zeres, which could mean translated as a little bit, or it says in one span. So, the Mesunas Sion over here tells us what a zeres is. So actually, the Talmud tells us that every finger actually has a name. Like we have, you know, the little finger, ring finger. So the middle finger in Hebrew is called the Amma, because that's how you measure the cubits. The small finger is called a zeres. And why is it called a zeres? So the Mesudas Sion explains the significance of this. Because Rotzel Lomar wants to tell you, Hashir min ha'agudol ad etzva ha'katana ha'kriya zeres. The measurement from the thumb when it's stretched out until the tip of the thumb to the end of the middle finger, the etzva ha'katana, kriya zeres. This is called a zeres, v'chein zeres arko. And this is how some people measure it. For example, it says the breastplate of the Kohen Gadol was a zeres, which is approximately, as you know, if you can imagine, it's about, you know, 6 to 8 inches. That's how long. So in other words, he was six amos and then a zeres. So some people say, well, why do I need to know that he was six amos and a zeres? So what? He's six amos tall. Because a lot of times, as we know throughout the Torah, it's written in a language of guzma, exaggeration. But the fact that it tells us that he was six amos and a zeres, it tells us that was his exact height. That it wasn't an exaggeration. This guy was huge. This guy was a monster. And obviously, someone you wouldn't be very comfortable starting up with. Now Rashi tells us, which is similar to the words of the Radak, as well as the Mesudas David, so we'll just see Rashi. Rashi says, Ish habinoyim, gibor, means he was a very strong man, so you can imagine. Shiatsa marachto, that he went out from his troops, from his army, lamod bein shtei hamarachot, to stand in between these two armies. So that's what it means. And in fact, the Mesudas David translates it even more literal. He says the last words, which I made a little bit a thicker underline, lashon bein, between, that he was ish, a man who was between many people. So that's the explanation of Rashi as well as Mesudas David, what it means that he was an ish habanim. Now some people explain that Goliath was really, as we're going to see, not a very humble man. We're going to see that very clearly. Rather, he wore his heart on his sleeve, and his emotions and his approach to life was in a very haughty manner. He was revealed himself. A person who's humble you don't say everything. You keep all your greatness to yourself. Someone who's a haughty person reveals it all, and that's when a person reveals something. It's called something which is giloy, something which is in the outside, revealed. So some say that's really the root of this man's name is Golios. It means goloy. He was someone who revealed himself, which was not a positive light. He was in a very negative way, that he was so haughty and open in that way. The Mishpatzos Zahav presents a very incredible statement exactly who this person was, his relationship, who his mother was, and why was it necessary that of all people, the person that needs to fight him has to be David? Like, why has it to be David? It could be anyone. What's the big deal? It has to be David. So we're going to end up seeing that the king was so petrified of this guy, he ends up making a deal that whoever defeats him can marry my daughter. So that's an obvious in for David right there. But it's brought down that if we study the book of Ruth, we know that Ruth also had, well, going back, Ruth had someone else by the name of Arpah that were daughter-in-laws to...
You mean Naomi had...
They were daughter-in-laws to Naomi. Naomi, those were Naomi's daughter-in-laws. Okay. And as the story goes, of course, they both were interested after their, you know, they were possibly going to remain, you know, not Jewish. They were perhaps being persuaded not to convert. Ruth says, "Too bad, I'm still doing it. Wherever you go, I'll go," the whole spiel. When it came to Arpa, she walked away. She at first was with Naomi, but eventually she walked away. And it's brought down that Arpa, when she walked away, it says, and so I'm just reading what it tells us over here by Chazal, it says, "Beholcha," that Arpa, when she went, "beyarda," and she went down, she lowered herself, spiritual, "shafgir atzmo," she completely opened herself up to all forms of impurity. She became a terrible, wicked woman, a Russia. So much so, says Chazal, that when it says that he was a man, bein, as it says in this pasuk, that he was a man, bein habanim, ish habanim, it means that he was so unsure who his father was that he was considered between many, many people because of how lewd she was in her interaction with Gilead Arias in acting inappropriately. Now, therefore, Arpa, and one of Arpa's children was this guy, Goliath. And one of Ruth's descendants, as we know, was David. So therefore, we find over here that the person, in fact, the Talmud tells us the reason why Ruth was given this name, Ruth, the Gemara asks, what's the significance of this name? So the Gemara says that she merited in the future that she will have a child, a great-grandchild, by the name of David, that Shiruya, which similar to the word Rus, that he will become very much involved in shiros v'tishbachos. It literally means to be intoxicating with songs and praises to God. And therefore, that was the connection of Ruth to David and Arpa to Goliath. And therefore, as the Chazal tell us, Zeh kenegen zeh as Elokim, let fire fight with fire to see who will be able to be the victor. And therefore, that's how some explain the significance of this war.
Rabbi, Arpa was a Moabite. She married into the Plishtim.
Apparently, either.
So she was raped by a Plishti, or not?
It was, the Chazal say it was done willingly. She willingly was with many men.
How did this Moabite woman get to the Plishtim?
Why is it necessary to do it?
What? I'm just telling you what it says. I'm not sure exactly why it's happened that way.
It sounds to me like Ishmael is a politician. He goes between...
Right. Well, that's the simple... It could be...
We all know that however you described him, it sounds like a politician.
Right. It's a different interpretation. But... What? Brought down in the commentator's name is the Rashbam, which it's from the actually from the Talmud, quoting a section in the Talmud, the Sechet Kala. So
wasn't there another explanation that Orpha cried 4 tears and then she was zocher for that to have four?
We're gonna end up seeing in the Radak later on that she walked 40 paces, and because of that we're gonna see that's connected to their. The Plishtim were going to be victorious for 40 days.
And also that she was going to have 4 sons, and one of them was supposed to be Goliath because of that crying, 4 tears.
That I didn't see, but I mean, no, it's very possible. Okay. Anyway, so whichever way you want to interpret it, we're now going to see this person, Goliath. In his strength, his power. Pasuk Pasuk tells us exactly what type of armor he wore. The kova, he wore a hat of nechoshes, of copper, al rosho, good place to put it, on his head. Vishirion kaskasim hulavush, and he wore this special army armor, which was like we find by fish. What there, it's necessary for a fish to be kosher, has to have snapir kaskasas, fins and scales, which means that that's how it looked. It was had all these interwoven areas. That's how Rashi over here translates it. Kamin kaskasas dagim, just like the fish, which means that there was no room possibly for any weapons to be able to penetrate into his armor. Umishkal hashirion chameshas alafim shekolim nechoshes. If you're interested in knowing how heavy this was, the weight of his armor was 5,000 copper shekel, which is pretty heavy. But he was obviously a big guy, so but nonetheless he was well protected. Pasuk Vav tells us, umischas nechoshes araglav. In addition to this helmet and this armor that he wore, he also wore shields which were covering up his legs, so his feet wouldn't get cut up. Bikido nechoshes ben kseifav, and he also wore this type of copper to protect between his shoulders by his neck. So he was doing all right over here. He's in pretty good shape. Okay, the next pasuk tells us as we turn to page 108. It says v'eitz, but you see that it's not really written that way. It's v'cheitz. We'll talk about that in a second. Chaniso kimnar argim v'laheves chaniso sheshmeo shekolim barzel. So he had this very huge, thick in diameter, this spear, which is translated over here as like a weaver's beam, and the blade of the spear was 600 iron shekel. The nose had sina hoylech lefanav, and not only that, I mean, no one could touch him. But just in case there was a nose had sina, there was another person who protected him that walked in front of him, which means that just in case, you can never be too careful. So that was how well protected he was, that there was even a nosei hatzina, even a person, a shield bearer, it says here, that walked in front of him. And some explain that this shield bearer is a famous guy. It's not brought down anywhere here. Some say it was Uri Hachiti, which we're going to end up seeing eventually. Right now he's on the Plishtim side. Eventually he's going to end up joining the Israelites and becoming one of the most powerful soldiers for David, until some things end up happening. Whatever, something ends up happening that David puts him on the front lines, ultimately he'll die. But right now, some interpret that Nosit Sina, the one who protected Goliath, was actually Uri Hachiti at this particular time. So, one of the questions one could look at and say, it says V'eitz Chaniso, but nonetheless, that's the way it's actually read. But the way it's written is not with an ayin, but rather with a chet, v'chetz. So what's the significance of this? So Chazal tell us that chetz comes from the word chatzi, half, which means that the description of all this armor, which the Me'am Lois actually says it was approximately 175 pounds, based on the whole calculation of how heavy his armor was. That's how heavy it was, 175 pounds. Says Chazal, he states, actually it's brought down in the Gemara, that Amar Elezer, Adayin el Higyan el Chatzi Shivchel Shel Osa Rasha. This is not even half the praises of this wicked person. So therefore, that's the reason why it says Chetz, or Chatzi. That's the way it's actually written in the Navi. But we read eight. But it's to allude to the idea that what you're reading here is not really all of his strength. It's only half of his strength. So why, if that's so, do we not mention all of his strength? So the Talmud says, Mikan she'asu l'saper b'shivcha shorashayim. You're not allowed to praise wicked people excessively. For our storyline, we have to at least get a picture of how strong he was. But to completely discuss how powerful of a man he was, that we don't want to do. That's the reason why it says, V'chatz, that only half of his praises are we going to mention, but not everything, because we never want to praise a rasha, a wicked person. Okay. Pasuchet. So you can imagine he's a pretty scary guy. Vayamod vayikram el marchos Yisrael. So he would stand in the middle, looking up at all these Jewish people, this huge army. He was the representative for this entire army. Vayamod him, he said, Lama teitzul arach mochama. Why is this whole business that we're all going to go out to war? It doesn't make any sense. We have millions of people, you have millions of people, let's say, and what's going to happen is thousands, tens of thousands of people are going to die in the battlefield. But what's the whole point of that? And so one person's going to win, one army's going to lose. It makes much more sense, and this happens a lot of times. It happened certainly in the Roman era. Halo anochi haplishti, I'm a Philistine. I'm a plishti. That's who I show my allegiance to. V'atem avadim l'shol. You guys, whoever you are, you're a bunch of servants. You show your loyalty to a different king, to Shol. Baruchem ish, choose one guy. V'yeredei lion, he'll come down to me. And we'll fight. We'll fight to the death. We'll see one more pasuk. Im yuchol l'lachim iti, if he's able to fight me. V'ikani and defeat me. V'ayinu l'chem l'avadim. Then all the Philistines will be servants unto you. And if I'm able to be victorious, the victor in this war, this man-to-man, mano-a-mano, then you'll end up being servants upon the Philistines. So it doesn't make any sense to have all of us fight a war. What's the whole point of it? You pick your best guy. I'm a pretty strong guy. I'm the representative of the Philistines. And that's it. Whoever wins will be the one who will rule over the one who had lost. Okay. Let's see Rashi. Rashi tells us, Lama Tetzin, why should you all come out? Says Rashi, Kulchem l'arach mulcham, why should you guys all come out to war? Yilochem echad kenegdi b'shul kulchem. Let one person fight on all of your behalf, and that will be enough. The next Rashi, Halo anochi haplishti, after looking at me, I'm just a lowly Philistine, I'm just a simple guy. Says Rashi, I'm not a powerful man. Ani lo sarmeyav, lo sarelef, I'm not an officer of 100 people. I don't give orders to 100, and certainly not to 1,000. I'm not a powerful man. I'm not a general. El plishti, I'm just a Philistine. Ke'echemin ha'cher, I'm just like any of these other guys. But really, Rashi says he wasn't just acting like a humble person. Rashi tells us that this alludes to other wars that he fought. This was a warrior. This was a man who was involved for many years in fighting. The even though I fought against you before, I fought many wars. I want to tell you a little bit of my historical military history. Ani harati chafni u'finchas. There was these two guys, their names were Chafni and Pinchas. I am the one that killed them. Chafni and Pinchas was the son of, right, Eli's sons. Eli's sons who, they brought the Aron, beginning of Sefer Shmuel, against the Pelishtim. They were losing the war, they brought the Aron out. Hopefully that will invoke some type of mercy and compassion from God that will be able to be victorious. Unfortunately, it didn't happen. Chafni and Pinchas were killed. And subsequently, Rashi says, you know what else I did after Chafni and Pinchas, the guardians of the Ark, what did I do? Shavi says, Aron. And I captured the Aron. I was the one that took it. V'yaten nasisim avanim l'sha'ol. And you are servants to Sha'ol. V'lo hoshiyaschem yama b'gvaraso. And he has not saved you in your days with his strength. Which basically he's saying that I am a very powerful person, and I will be able to defeat anyone that stands in my way. And some people actually say that this Rashi is coming to allude to the fact that he was demanding that the person that should fight him would be Shaul himself. Because if we remember, long before Shaul was the king, Shaul came back somehow, some way, not with the Aron, but at least with the... Does anyone remember? He came back to Eli with the Aseres Hadibrot, the Ten Commandments, which were actually inside the Aron. He somehow managed to get them, and he brought them back to Eli. So the question is, how on earth was he able to do it? Obviously, if this guy, Goliath, had the Aron, and presumably he didn't take them out before. This was one explanation. Maybe he took them out before he came, and then he ran before. Some explain that actually he was able to fight against Goliath and have at least the ability to take this Sarasat Dibros from him. So therefore, some say Goliath is telling him, I want to fight Shaul. I want a rematch against this guy, one-on-one. Which we're going to end up seeing. It makes sense, because he was really the powerful person, the king. And instead, David, who really is now the king, who's already anointed, he will be the one that will take over this position, fighting this war. Okay, so that's the backdrop of what this person, what Goliath was hoping to do, hoping to be able to defeat one person, and in turn, be able to rule over the entire Jewish nation. Continuing in the next pasuk, we're up to pasuk Yud, verse 10. Vayomer ha-Pilishti, and the Philistine said, Ani chiravti es marchos Yisrael. He says, this Philistine said, I've disgraced your entire army, hayom hazeh, on this day. Tenuli ish, give me a man, benulchamo yachad, and let me fight with him. He disgraced him because he saw he kept saying this over and over, and no Jewish person was willing to stand up. No one was willing to accept this role, this responsibility. And therefore he said, I've disgraced you, because it's clear that there's not a single person among you that have the ability to defeat me, to be able to even want to try, have the courage to fight against me. Pasuk Yud-Aleph, Vayishma Shaul v'chol Yisrael, as Dibur ha-Pelishti o'ele, of course the king Shaul, as well as the entire Jewish army, heard these words of this Philistine, Vayechatu v'yiru ma'od. Vayechatu, the Mesuna Sion here tells us, is in Pachad v'shever, they were afraid, there was tremendous trepidation, they were concerned, very much terrified against this mighty warrior. Okay. In the meantime, which now you see it's almost like a new paragraph, because this is what's happening in the battlefield. Now, the David, where's David? David seems like he was a powerful guy. Maybe he was in the battlefield. Maybe he was the one, after all, if he is going to be fighting Goliath, probably he was already there with his war paint and his sword or whatever it may be, ready to fight. That's not what happened at all. David was a young guy, and David was not in the battlefield, as we'll see. But David ben Ish Ephrasi Hazad, David, who was the son, person from Ephras, Mibes Lechem, this place, Mibes Lechem Yehuda, Ushmo Yishai, if you can't remember his father's name, we'll tell it to you again, it's Yishai, Velo Shimon Abanim, and to him he had 8 sons. Yishai had 8 children, even though we saw before he had 7, we'll see what that means. And this man, who was Yishai, who would generally be standing by Shaul and be willing to fight, he was a Zakin Baba Banoshim. He was already an elderly man, Yishai. Which, as we're going to see in the Radak, means he was really too old to be able to be involved in the bloodshed of a battlefield of a war. We look at Rashi over here. Rashi says, what does it mean he has Velo Shmona Banim? That Yishai had 8 children. Umashikasu, that which is written in the Book of Chronicles, Dibur HaYomim, it says, Otsem Hashishi David Hashvi'i V'lo Sivyoter. It talks about Otsem was the 6th, David was the 7th, and that was it. It doesn't mention any more children of Yishai. So how could it say over here that he had 8 children, when in fact in Dibur HaYomim it accounts for only 7? So some say, possibly one of his children had died prematurely, and therefore his name was not mentioned because of that tragedy that happened to one of his children. So he really had 8. One of them we don't know about, because presumably the child probably had passed away, and therefore we're only really familiar with 7 of them. Okay. Now, if we look at the Radak tells us, which is the part which is underlined toward the bottom of the page, how many of these 8 or 7 children of Yishai were actually on the battlefield? So the Radak says, Shloshes b'nei Yishai ha'yusham b'melchama. Only 3 of Yishai's children were engaged in war. V'dai hu lehem b'beis Yishai. That was sufficient. She'ayu lo shmona banim You don't have to send all of your children out to war. That's too much to ask. That we're not going to do. But if you have, I guess they had some type of sliding scale. I mean, kid you had. But if you had 8 children, 3 children were enough to represent your family in Muhammad war. So how about the father? Maybe Yishai would be a good, powerful veteran to be on the battlefield. So the Radak says, Yishai Atzal Hoyim Muhammad. He himself, Jesse, was not in the war. Because he was already an older individual. And that's what the Radak, the 2 lines below, says. By Zakin Baba Anashim, Ba'anche Hazikna, the Hachulsha, because of his older age, and because he had lost his strength of his youth, Shohay Yochalatseis Blabo. He wasn't able to go out as he used to, and therefore he would not be an effective warrior, therefore he did not fight in the battlefield. So, Dovid was not in the battlefield, rather, 3 of his older siblings were in the battlefield. We see that Dovid was the youngest of them all. Okay. Alright. Which is really what we're going to see in the Pasuk Yudalad in a moment. But in the meantime, let's continue with Pasuk Yud Gimel. Pasuk Yud Gimel tells us, verse 13, V'yelchu shloshes b'nei Yishai ha'gadolun. So the 3 of Jesse's older children went to war. Hochel achrei Shaul Muhammad, they followed Shaul the king to be engaged in battle. B'shem shloshes b'nei, if you can't remember from last chapter, we'll tell you again. The name of 3 children of Yishai, asher Hochel and Muhammad, that went out to war, were Eliav, who was Bachor, he was the firstborn. Umishnehu, the next one in line was Avinadav. Vashlishi, and the third one is Shama. So those were 3 of the children of Yishai. Again, their names were Eliav, Avinadav, and Shama. Those were the 3 children that were in war. However, David was not, because the Pasuk says that David, Hu Hakatan, he was small. He was a young boy. He was a little kid. So it makes sense that he wouldn't be able to fight.
He wasn't so young.
He was the Katan means he was the youngest, I should say. Katan apparently means he was. We'll discuss other translations of Katan in a moment. We'll just finish this passage. Rather, again, it repeats, the 3 older children are the ones that went after in the war to fight with King Shaul. So some say David, when it says David with Katan, as we saw, when there was a whole lineup, they're trying to figure out, bless you, like, who should we pick? Who's the right king? So they said, this guy, no, until they didn't even have David at all on the lineup. Where's David? Oh, he's with the sheep. He's hanging out with a bunch of animals, you know, as a shepherd. So they're like, no, he's the one that's going to be the next king. So it shows David is a katan, doesn't mean necessarily he's small, physically small, or young in age, but it means he was a tremendous anav. He was such a humble person that he was a katan. He made himself as though he was small. That's how some people interpret it.
They say anashim, they don't say
talking about Yishai.
Yishai. It's not, when they mention somebody old, it's both small and older.
Right.
So,
and Baba Yamim
is old. When you say Baba Anashim, would it mean that he's important, that he's amongst the men?
That's what the English translation says. He went amongst the elders.
Baba Anashim. He's involved with judgments, with politics. He's involved. He's an involved man.
That's nice. That's good. Right, that he was older, but that he was very important still.
That means that he's an important man.
Right. In fact, I didn't quote it, but it is brought down that he had a tremendous following. Yishai had at this point.
Yeah.
It's not brought down here, those words, but that is how they interpret this. The greatness of Yishai was that he had a tremendous following, that people listened to him and gave advice. Right. So that's right. That makes sense when they talk about David. They again quote, his father's name is Yishai, because like people might not have known David.
You
but Yishai people certainly would know of. So that's a possibility. Very good. And Mesudas David over here explains another interpretation of the one who means katan. The David who katan, which is toward the bottom of the page, it just tells us the idea that maybe not that he was a three-year-old, right? He wasn't a little baby. Obviously, he's a grown man. But at the same time, when it came to the person who was going to be picked among the family members in war, it was always the oldest children that were picked, I guess, until they would maybe reach a certain age. But because he was the katan, the youngest, or younger than his siblings, therefore he was not the one, he was not among the three chosen to actually fight in the war. Okay, so that's the interpretations of that pasuk. Moving on to the next pasuk, Tet Vav, verse 15. V'David holich v'shav mi'al sha'ol. So David himself, while his brothers were involved in battle, or about to fight, he was traveling back and forth, liros etzon aviv beis lachem. And he was constantly going to the sheep where his father was in Beit Lachem, which is an incredible statement because David was already in the palace. He was already had a rapport, a relationship with the king. He used to play musical instruments for him, but he was very much involved in a very intimate relationship with this man, with this king. And yet he was did not consider too lowly of a position that whenever he had the opportunity availed itself, he would always go back to remain to be the shepherd for his father. So the Philistines, when would they start up with the Jewish people, that the Jewish people would have to be on their toes and ready to be engaged in battle? In the morning
and at night.
We'll see the significance of that Rashi in a moment. And he presented himself, this wicked Philistine, Goliath, for 40 days. He had some type of power and control that he was able to scare the Jewish people for 40 days. Now, what exactly does this mean? In the morning, at the night, that the Philistine would start up with the Jewish people precisely at that time. So Rashi tells us a very interesting explanation, quoting actually the Talmud and Sotah. If we look at the very last Rashi on this page 108, it says, why did they get up specifically in the morning and the evening to start up with the Jewish people? Amru Rabotenu, so the rabbis teach us of blessed memory, Kedei Levatlam Mikriyashma, in order that the Jewish people should withhold themselves from saying the Shema, which some people learn that it's an incredible statement, which means if the Jewish people, the Philistines knew that if all we would have in our hands and our back pockets was just the mitzvah of saying the Shema in the morning and the evening, that would be enough to defeat them. And therefore they realized that the only way that we could possibly be defeated is if they would start up with us specifically in the morning and the evening to not allow us to have the proper kavanah, the proper mindset to say the Shema properly. That some interpret that in the Shema, one of the first sentences, the first sentence of the Shema, it says you're supposed to love Hashem b'chol levavcha b'chol nafshecha b'chmodecha. It says you're supposed to love Hashem with all your heart and all of your soul. And some interpret, the Talmud says, afilu noyitel es nafshecha, even if you have to give of your own life to be able to serve God. And therefore, that would have perhaps inspired the soldiers, if they would have said those words, b'chol nashecha, that would have given them the courage to fight against the Plishtim and realize that that's their obligation, even if they have to give up their own lives. So the Philistines didn't want them to have that thought process and therefore remain cowards and scared from fighting against them. So that's how some interpret this idea, the greatness of a single mitzvah that a Jewish person can fulfill and that will give us a tremendous zechut, tremendous merit. And we look at the Radak. The Radak over here is on page 109. It's in the English because the Radak is lengthy. So the Radak tells us what exactly on page 109, you'll see it's the only part which is in Hebrew in the middle of the page, that the Jewish people were being provoked for 40 days by this Philistine. What's the significance of 40 days? 40 days we have often. But here's another instance. So the Radak tells us, there's two parts I'd like to talk about. B'siyasiv Arboim Yom, he brings down a medrash, which is Arboim Yom, Keneged Arboim Yom Shenit Mehem Torah. The 40 days that we were provoked by the Philistines, and specifically by this powerful man Goliath, corresponds to the 40 days in which the Jewish people were waiting to receive the Torah. Kolom, that is to say, Shlo hayu lehem koach Yisrael al Goliath, that the Jewish people do not have any power against Goliath, or any of our adversaries for that matter, El ad sof arboim, until the end of those 40 days. Those first 40 days would be provoked. Ki b'sof arboim yom, after the 40 days, Shiorid Moshe min ahar, Kibul HaTorah, that the Jewish people accepting the Torah after Moshe Rabbeinu coming down for 40 days. So therefore it's telling us it was the schus, the koach, the power of us accepting the Torah, which really means having a relationship with God, that God will protect us. That's the time when Hashem will protect us. But until those 40 days have completed, when we do not have this intense relationship, similar to a bride to a groom, a chasen to a kala, was the Jewish people to God, until that point, people were able to defeat us. We were vulnerable. He brings down another medrash, a medrash Shmuel, which is on the left side over here in the Radak. The significance of the 40 is arboyim pesios, 40 steps, that holcha arpa im chamosa na'ami, that arpa was walking, taking a nice little stroll with her mother-in-law, Naomi, and after that, she kind of, they went separate ways. She realized that Judaism was not her thing. It was chuta. But the fact that she walked for those 40 steps, in that merit, nitla livnar boim yom, her son had this power, this chut, for 40 days. As the Talmud says, Aim Goliath Zuhi Arpa. The mother of Goliath was Arpa. And therefore, because of those 40 days that she walked, that was the zechut, that was enough of a merit that her child would be protected. We're going to see in the next two psukim, we'll stop. Pasuk Yud Zayin. Vayomer, Yishai LeDavid Beno, and Yishai said to David, his son, Kachna L'Achecha Eifas HaKali Hazeh. Go ahead and take these loaves of bread, the asar lechem hazeh, and take this toasted grain and these breads, the hareta machna lechecha, and I want you to hurry up and to give them to the camp for your brothers, because they were not able to move out of their camp, and the resources, all their food was depleted. They didn't have any food left. So he said, go to your brothers. And give them this bread so that they're not going to starve to death. Pasuk Yuchet. The ace aseres charitzei hacholov ha'ela, and these pieces of cheese, tavi l'sar ha'elef, give it to the powerful captain who controls the thousand. Like a general, the powerful person, so that he'll be able to have nourishment to be able to give the guidance to his soldiers. Yes, achecha tivko l'sholom, yes, aruba san tikach, and you should go and inquire, as this is their welfare, and you should take aruva sam. You should take a report of their welfare. So what exactly does it mean, aruva sam? So let me just finish this next pasuk first before we get to another, so we'll stop. Shol v'heim v'chol ish Yisrael b'emek ha'ela. So Shol and all the army was in this valley, nilchamim in Plishtim, to wage war against the Plishtim. So what was it that David was supposed to do? So Rashi says that this powerful man that he was supposed to give the cheese to was Yonah's son, which is Shol's son. The next part of the Rashi says, I want you to give me the report of their success and their welfare and report it back to me. I want to know how his children were doing in the war. We jump down to the next part of the Rashi. Rashi tells us an interesting thing that was done in those days, the Jewish people who were engaged in war, because of an issue which is called in Hebrew aguna. Rashi says, Rabbi Seinu Amru, the rabbis teach us, get krisos yikach mi'itam. I want you to get a divorce document from your three brothers. Things are looking bleak over there. Get this divorce document, which is called a get, and give it to their wives, Blahafrid Eruv Shebeinu Levina, so that they will be able to have the opportunity to be separate from one another. So Yishai was concerned. This was, and these were his children. So therefore, these were only daughters through marriage, right? His daughters through marriage. And he was extremely sensitive to the issue that if they would die on the battlefield and no one would know and be able to testify to this effect, then perhaps they would remain agunot forever. Now, one other explanation, which we'll conclude with, is the reason why I want to say this was because of our parsha that we just had last week. Aruvasam could also mean a guarantor. We found in last week's parsha that there was someone that was made themselves as a guarantor for someone else. Who was that? Binyamin, who Yaakov was concerned. Exactly. Yehuda accepted as a guarantor for Binyamin. He said, I will guarantee you, my father, that he will come back. So he says that the explanation over here of Aruvasam is the exact same thing here. Because if we look at, right, if we look at Shaul, Shaul came from which tribe?
Binyamin.
He came from Binyamin. And the question is, how can you guarantee, David, how can you guarantee that Binyamin, the tribe of Binyamin, will be safe? It's with David himself. And David comes from which tribe? Yehuda. So it's the exact same thing that Aruvasam, that just in the days of the Torah itself, that Yehuda was willing to defend and protect his brother Binyamin, so too he was being instructed, David is being instructed in this hidden way, that he will be the guarantor for the future, this future person of Binyamin, specifically Shaul and his children. I'll stop here.